Hi, and welcome to another of our Canny Conversations podcasts, powered by the Pathway Group. My name's Mark Wakeley, and I'm one of the team who bring you these podcasts each week. In this series, Safraz Ali will be talking to some of the business people he's met and worked with in his 23 years at the heart of the West Midlands business community. And of course, many of the businesses that are part of the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance. In this episode, Safraz is in conversation with Jill Whittaker from HIT Training, a long-standing advocate for the apprenticeship sector. In the first half of our two-part conversation, Jill shares her journey from growing up in the Midlands to receiving an OBE for her work in apprenticeships. The conversation delves into the importance of long-term skills planning, leadership development, and the impact of COVID and Brexit on the training industry. Jill also discusses initiatives in the hospitality and care sector, emphasising the need for inclusivity and support for individuals with learning differences in apprenticeships. Keep listening for an insightful discussion on the future of skills development and training in the UK. So let's join the conversation.
So welcome to another podcast, Canny Conversations podcast. We're still in series five, but it is our first recording in the year 2024, and it's my absolute pleasure and honour to introduce you to somebody who I met probably about 15 years ago. I shared a stage with her, and it was my first sort of public speaking gig, if I can say that. And I was a bag of nerves, and I'm feeling that now at the moment. And I want to introduce you to a long-standing advocate for our sector, Jill. Thank you so much, Jill Whittaker from HIT Training. Welcome to Birmingham, your hometown, and welcome to this podcast.
Thank you, Saf. It's lovely to be here.
Much appreciated. As I sneakily said that, it is your sort of hometown as such. You know, you are a Birmingham lass, if I can say.
I am.
Yeah, a greater Birmingham lass. So tell us a little bit about early days in terms of your connection with Birmingham, and then we'll hopefully move on to the journey that's led you here, really.
I grew up in the Midlands, North Warwickshire,
and
eventually found my way into Birmingham doing my accountancy qualifications.
Yeah.
So I did that as I suppose you could call it really an apprenticeship. It wasn't called an apprenticeship then. We called it articles.
Yeah.
We had 4 years, and that's when we did all of our study. So I was in Colmore Row for most of that time. I love Birmingham.
Okay.
I adore it. I adore the whole town centre. The people are marvellous. They're the kindest, warmest and funniest people you've ever met. Many years ago, I'm a football fan, and I had a season ticket at Aston Villa. And I knew these chaps who used to stand in the same area as me for years. And one day, one of the guys, after about 3 or 4 years, said, what is it you do for a living, Jill? And I said, I'm an accountant. And he, quick as lightning, said, what, a turf accountant?
Really?
Which is what, bookie, you know, back in the days we used to call a bookie.
Bookie,
exactly.
Yeah.
I love the sense of humour. Yeah. That is so Birmingham, isn't it? So Birmingham. So, yeah, I see. My
Thank
heart's
you.
Here.
Thank you. I want to congratulate you as well in terms of your recognition for the OBE, which you got for in 2022, for your work in the apprenticeship sector and for hospitality and care. Let me get my words right. It's for apprenticeships in hospitality and care. So, again, congratulations on that. It must have been a big surprise, big achievement. It's again, you know, well deserved. How did that feel? And how, you know,
I honestly, you can't believe it, that kids like me from mining villages, you know, working class kids from mining villages, don't get OBEs from the Queen. And it was the Queen then, of course. I mean, sadly, she passed away before she was able to give it to me. But her son, Charles, kindly stepped in, and I had a lovely day with my family at Windsor Castle. And it was done in a very different way. When my colleague John got his CBE, I went along with him to Buckingham Palace. But my award was given to me by Charles. In the room, there was just myself and him, his assistant, and my family. So it wasn't like a big procession or lots of people sitting and waiting. It was just us. It was really personal, and it felt very warm. And I said to, as I went in, I said to Charles's assistant, you know, what's the protocol? And he said, don't worry about protocols. He said, walk up to him, nod your head. You can step backwards when you've finished. He said, but talk as long as you like about whatever interests you. So Charles said to me, He said, you've been doing this a very long time. And I said, yes, I was a small child when I started. And he giggled. And then we just chatted for about 5 minutes and talked about the Prince's Trust and the work that he does there. And also he talked about some of my friends who, well, he didn't know they were friends of mine, but he'd had a reception for the hospitality industry at Buckingham Palace the week before. And a number of my good friends and colleagues from the sector had been there. So we talked about that. So yeah, it was a really interesting and warm sort of very personal event. And yeah, I of course I'm very proud. I'm really sad that my mum and dad aren't around to have known about it, because they'd have been pretty blown away. My father wasn't very keen on the royals, but my mother loved loved anything to do with royalty, so she'd have been over the moon. But hey,
no, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Jill. So you reckon, your recognition was for the hospitality and the care sector. We all know you as the advocate for the hospitality sector. You know, you've been vocal, you've been representing the sector for many, many years. And it is a big part of your identity. You know, when you talk about Jill Whittaker, automatically people think hospitality. They think about some of the issues that you've raised, some of the challenges that you've raised, and you've been a big sort of cheerleader, an advocate for the sector. So again, you know, that's synonymous with your identity, you know, in terms of, you know, anybody mentions your good name, it has to be linked straight away with hospitality. And possibly less so people know about the care element of it, but that's a big growing part in terms of the care and some of the other stuff. But hospitality seems to be straight away, people sort of mention that. Is that fair for me to say, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I was very, very honoured this year. Well, actually just before Christmas, to be given a lifetime recognition award by the National Industry Training Awards for the hospitality and pub sector, which is a great honour. And it's unusual, because the vast majority of winners of, or people who've been recognised there, have been actual operators, people who run a pub group or a restaurant or whatever. Yeah. So for me to have been recognised in that way was delightful. Yes, I'm very well known in that sector, and less so in care, although our Connector Care brand is very well recognised in the care sector. And my colleague Kirsty Simmons leads on care for us, and she's very well known. She works on the Trailblazers for the care apprenticeships. She's very engaged in the sector, and I also have other sector leads who represent parts of, because our care sector work is not just adult care. We have early years care, and also funeral care. We're the only national training provider that provides apprenticeships in funeral care. Funeral care is always steady business. just let you know. But yes, they're not big numbers, funeral care, because a lot of people who work in that sector tend not to have really recognised apprenticeships as a pathway. But we're helping them to understand more about that now.
So, Jill, talk to us a little bit about the main brand that you're known as, Hospitality Industry Training, or HIT Training. A little bit about the organisation in terms of the current size, the shape of it, and some of the infrastructure that you have, some of the footprint that you have, and just some numbers, if you can, behind the name.
Of course. I mean, well, we started HIT in 2006, so we've been going for quite some time now. Mm-hmm. And it was predominantly hospitality at the time in parts of the country where we were unable to get contracts with the government. Then we had care contracts instead, but mostly it was hospitality back there. And we started the business with a group of friends and ex-colleagues, many of whom had been made redundant from the company that had bought out our previous company, which was called Hospitality Plus. So there was a little bit of a synergy there. So if you fast forward to now, well, I suppose in the meantime, we've had COVID, and we've had changes in apprenticeship regimes, and we've had all sorts of different things have happened. The levy, pre-apprenticeship levy, we were a very different shaped business. 80% of our learners would have been working in SMEs prior to the apprenticeship levy. But we saw that when the levy was introduced, an awful lot of SMEs made the choice of getting out of that market, really. They didn't have the spare cash to put the 5% in. Transfers weren't available at that time. So we had to move our business from one place to another around then, 2017. And, of course, we've had COVID since. Mm. So just before COVID, we were on a run rate of about 30 million turnover a year.
Right.
And we're now around, this year we should do about 22 million. So it's been a big reduction.
Sizable reduction.
Yeah, sizable. But, you know, if you think about the sectors in which we operate, during those couple of years of COVID, hospitality sector was pretty much closed. We had plenty of people completing their programs, but, of course, no new people starting, or very, very few new people starting programs. And the care sector was completely overwhelmed. So, again, people who worked in that sector are able to commit the time that they needed. So that period of sort of 2020, 21, and even into 22 has been a really just put the kibosh on the business, really, from our perspective. And we fought hard to keep our heads above water, like many other training providers and other businesses out there. I would say, you know, we are mostly hospitality and care. Whatever happens in those sectors is going to have an impact on us. You know, if I see that the hospitality sector is struggling to recruit staff, you can, sure as eggs is eggs, we are going to be struggling to recruit staff as well, because we're all working in the same pool of talent. So where we are at the moment is helping to extend that pool of talent, helping our employers to really offer something that people want out of their working lives, to be able to improve their own skills, for the employers to have a more efficient, effective business. And it all goes around in a great big virtuous circle.
So, Jill, you said you were on target. Your trajectory was around the 30 million mark, which is a fairly sizable training company, you know, one of the larger ones in the country. And obviously you've been affected by, we've all been affected by the COVID, but there's been a change since then as well, which is the Brexit change. So not only is it the COVID elements of it, but how has Brexit affected, if at all?
Somewhat suboptimal.
Yeah.
Can I put it that way?
Okay.
I don't want to get too political, Staff. You know, anybody who knows me knows where I stand on all of these things, but it's difficult to see any benefits that have come from Brexit. At the moment, I'm not suggesting that that might not ever be the case, but as things stand at the moment, everyone's working with a tighter talent pool, and that does create challenges. I was talking to a general manager of one of the best hotels in London not very long ago, and she was saying that they've always had this model for their receptionists. They recruit people from all over Europe and the world who speak lots of languages, and they come to London to get a work experience. They get accommodation paid for. Mostly they only stay for a year or two, but they do a fabulous job while they're there, and they're supported. And she was saying she just can't pay the salary that is required of someone who you're importing from their skills from overseas now. So it's left her in a very difficult position, because British people traditionally aren't very good at languages. She's running a 5-star in London. She needs people. She's got 20 different languages being spoken in that hotel during a day. She needs people with those skills, and they don't exist. I think the thing about skills planning in our country is it's a little bit like where you ask the chap, how do I get to Birmingham from here? And you say, well, you don't start from here. It's the same sort of thing with skills planning. How are we going to get to a point where we've got all the skills in the country that we need? Well, we wouldn't want to start where we are. However, we don't start where we are. So what we need is some serious long-term planning that goes past the length of one parliament, that is outside of politics. If we want to get the sort of results that they get in Germany and they get in some of the rest of Europe, then we need to understand and engage in the same sort of processes. So a cross-party agreement that we need to build the skills in this country across at all levels. So, you know, there's been a focus on higher level skills, and that's great, fantastic. But it's no good having a general manager of a hotel if there's no one to do the cleaning. It's one team. We all have to work together. So we need to have a full skills plan that is longer than the next couple of years or whenever the next election is, so that we can all make the commitment and put in the investment that's needed. Employers can have certainty about what it is that's coming in the future. And I think that's what you hear a lot at the moment about apprenticeship reform, levy reform, how that can be done. And I think there's an awful lot of conversation about the detail of it. But actually, what we really need is an overall agreement that says, fundamentally, we are here. We need to get to here. It's going to take us 10 years. So let's walk backwards and say, what are the steps we need to put in place to get us to where we're going? I was at a really good meeting recently up at Parliament, and David Blunkett was there, and also Joe Johnson, MP, who was Boris's brother. And the two of them were so close in terms of what they wanted to achieve. It wasn't political. They were both individuals who were wanting to get that same long-term planning, long-term goals, get rid of the noise and really aim in that direction. That's where we've got to go.
In terms of the organisation, and we'll come back a little bit about the sector and the industry and the further education sector and also the industries that you represent, and I'll pick up on that. One of the things I wanted to sort of quickly introduce, we've talked about Connected Care and we've talked about HIT and the big strong brands within your organisation or within the group. But you've also got the work that you do in terms of leadership and development, and the Executive Development Network is a brand that you created a few years back. So talk to us a little bit about the need to create a separate sort of brand and identity, particularly targeting the sort of leadership management sort of void that's out there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Void is a really good word. Yeah. There isn't a lot of work-based education for leaders in organisations, and for teachers and for trainers and for people who do that development work.
Okay.
The apprenticeships exist, but they're relatively small in number. Mm. And I mean, actually, in fact, we're also looking at applying for degree awarding powers too, under that whole executive development piece.
Right.
So Executive Development Network was about getting the message out to the broader workplace that it's not absolutely essential to go to university to get your skills development. Mm. And what you can do, one of the things that we've always done with all of our clients is spend time with them, understanding not just what the individual needs and how they need to learn, but also what the employer needs. But our programs are very practical, even if some of them are quite high level fives and sixes, they're still very practical. They're still very focused on what it is we're seeking to achieve. Mm. And that we wanted to bring more of that to the workplace.
So just in terms of the qualifications that you're currently delivering, I mean, where would you say, is it predominantly shifting towards a sort of high level, or
high level? We've got the learning and development programs are in there, so learning mentor and learning development practitioner are within that brand. And there is a level 3 team leader, which is the first line of supervisory management.
Okay.
But the volume tends to be around that level 5 program.
Yeah.
We've got some level 7 as well in there, and smaller doses, so not as an apprenticeship, as certificate, diploma certificates and awards, and also higher technical qualifications. We've launched this year, we were fortunate to receive a government grant to support 150 people undertaking professional coaching diplomas, which at level 5, which we are launching any day now. So by the time this podcast goes out, that will be out there. And what we want to do with that initially is to help it to support. We've had huge demand, particularly from the hospitality industry, where we're very well known for a contextualised degree apprenticeship. It'll take a long time for a degree apprenticeship to be developed specifically for the hospitality industry. Mm. But as an interim measure, if we can contextualise the existing chartered manager degree apprenticeship for the industry, then there's real value in that. So that's our plan at the moment, which we're working on for this year. And we've had huge demand. As I say, over 350 places pledged in the first year, which is extraordinary, already pledged by organisations large and small, who all see the value of attracting young people, young talent into their organisations from school, from college. Whereas at the moment, there isn't really anything like that for the hospitality industry. Mm. But in terms of the higher technical qualification, we think that's a fantastic gateway to enable those businesses to develop somebody within their organisation who will be the coach and the mentor for those degree apprentices.
Okay.
So that's all happening at the moment. Yeah, we're not sitting back twiddling our thumbs.
Absolutely. Jill, I want to touch on the fact that with your Connected Care brand, which is very strong in the adult social care market, but you also do a lot of early years as well within that. Is that part of the same brand, or is that part of
Connected Care? all of the care work that we do, so adult health and social care, early years care, and funeral care, all come under the Connected Care brand.
Do you feel there's a growing market? I mean, obviously, the government every year, when there's a budget, they talk about early years, they talk about some of the extra sort of funds that they want to push towards getting people back into the workforce and so forth. So, do you feel that these are growing markets?
It is. In the early years sectors, particularly, it is very much the model for development of their talent, the apprenticeship. It's really well recognised. It's really well known. A lot of the early years organisations have their own employer provider status.
Yeah.
But there are many, many, many much smaller organisations. So
the SMEs, the smaller businesses, they obviously will go to a training provider, but a lot of the larger ones.
Some of the big ones too, but they're used to Ofsted. Mm. One of the things about the early years is they get Ofsted inspected anyway, so that it's not new to them. I think the employer provider model works if you really get and understand Ofsted. Mm. But we've seen some of our clients have tried it and just said, you know, this isn't for us. This isn't our main business isn't education. Our main business is something else. Education is part of what we do. So, yeah, I think the models within early years are quite different, but it's a huge market. I was chatting with somebody from one of our competitors in the early years market recently, and we were just saying, you know, if we all play nicely, there's plenty of business out there for all the training providers. When they don't play nicely, Saf, I let them know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do. We play nicely, and you don't go around trying to pinch everybody else's business. There's plenty of work out there for everyone.
Another division within the group is the endpoint assessment setup that you have, which is the professional assessment, which I think the name says it all really to a certain level. So tell us a little bit about this entity in terms of how that has come about and how does that work?
Yeah, well, endpoint assessment started around 2016-17 with the apprenticeship standards reform. And it just seemed to us that it made sense. We understand the apprenticeship market. It made sense that we were part of that market. Mm. The way that Professional Assessment Limited, or PAL, operates is completely arm's length from here. I have no operational input into the way that that organisation is run. It is run very ably by my friend and colleague of many years, Linda Martin, and, as I say, completely at arm's length and independently. Mm. And it's supporting a piece of the market that needed to be supported. They had to go through Ofqual approval a couple of years ago, which they did successfully. Mm. And my understanding is that now they're looking to expand into other markets. So hospitality and care they work in, but various other markets too. And they've been approached recently about looking at some of the teaching and learning programs too. So there's a lot of opportunity for them. But as I say, they do operate independently and they report into us, but we don't tell them what to do.
So you're a busy person, Jill. You've got a lot of hats that you wear. And I want to talk a little bit about some of those hats that you have been wearing and what you, you know, what you're known for. And some of the things you've been kindly sharing on LinkedIn, and some of those things we may not be prominently be aware of. But firstly, I want to talk a little bit about the transition in terms of your career, because you've been spearheading the organisation as effectively the managing director for many, many years. And then you had a sort of a transition now in terms of executive chair. That's happened a few months back. So talk to us a little bit about that transition. How's that come about? And how are you enjoying this new responsibility and this new role?
Well, we've known each other many years, Saf. So, you know, as I said to you previously, you know, when we met, we both had brown hair. And now neither of us do, but never mind. Never mind. So, yeah, I was 60 in October and I've taken stock of what I wanted to do with my life, really. Yeah. I had two knee replacements in April. So both of my knees were replaced. That took me out of circulation for a little while and gave me a bit of thinking time, especially since you're in such a lot of pain, you can't sleep.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of thinking time going on. And it made me realise that actually I needed to have a bit more time for myself.
Okay.
So I don't work full-time anymore. I work 3 days a week.
Okay.
But this wasn't sudden. I've been working on my leadership team and with them very, very closely for this transitional phase for many years. Mm. And had COVID not happened when it did, we probably would have made the changes sooner.
Okay.
But as it is, that's where we are. They're very well experienced. They've been around a long time, all of the people on my leadership team, and extremely trustworthy. They don't need me to tell them what to do, but it does help that, you know, I've been around a while. So that rather than managing the business, much more of a strategic input, much more coaching and support for the directors who remain. Our organisation changed status as well. The ownership of our organisation changed last year. You might not be aware, but we sold about 63% of the business into an employee ownership trust.
Okay.
So the majority of the business is now owned by the employees.
Okay.
And we used the cash that we had in the business plus some loan notes to the outgoing shareholders to fund that. That was a year coming up, a year in April.
Yeah.
Over the next 4 or 5 years, we will have paid down all of the debt that we used to fund all of that, at which time the organisation will be predominantly owned by the employees, and they will be making a lot more of the decisions around how we run it. We've always had that social enterprise sense, but of course, when we first started here, most of the staff took shares in the business to be able to support us to get going. Unfortunately, you can't keep issuing shares. Well, fortunately, unfortunately, you can't keep issuing shares because all you do is dilute the shareholding of the existing shareholders. Nobody wants that. So we found this as a way to allow our staff to participate more in the organisation. I don't know how much you know about it. It was a very tax efficient way of getting your staff to participate. We can, in years when we make a profit, we can pay up to £3,600 tax free bonus to each of our staff. We're not quite in the position to be able to do that at the moment, but that would be our intent in the future. So once the loan notes have been paid off and the organisation is debt-free, then that's what we're moving towards. And at that point, we will have an employee council who will report into the board of directors and have a member on our board of directors.
Okay. Jill, I wasn't aware of that aspect of it. And I'm aware that some organisations are heading that way, and they sort of call it the John Lewis type model to a certain level. And there's a bit more to it than that, because it gives individuals sort of a bit more investment in the organisation, and it's a great way to retain good quality staff and differentiate yourself from many other organisations out there. So I think it's a fantastic way, and it allows the existing shareholders, the people who've been there from day one, an exit, but at least a bit of a transition and to remain within the setup. I think CTEC did a similar model as well. So there are precedents for it, and it is something that more and more people are talking about. So I think, absolutely innovative and a fantastic way to do that, and great way to retain good people, and great way to sort of encourage new people to come and join the organisation. So has it been taken positively by people? Did they understand? Your staff, did they understand what was involved? And
yeah, absolutely. And we were very open about what we were doing, why we were doing it, and how we were going about it. I think for some of our staff, it's taken them a while to get their heads around. Because fundamentally, I guess, until the debt is all repaid, then it doesn't make a huge difference to most of the people. But that is a transitional piece as well. And, you know, if things are going very well, we'll pay it down sooner. We don't intend to stretch it out as long as we can. This is something we want to get done. And it's a conversation that I've had with the board of directors. It's not just a new managing director in Mike Worley, but over the last year, we've had a number of almost complete change, really, and all for the good. So that is one of our main strategic goals, is to pay that down and to move to full employee participation.
I mentioned just earlier on the fact that you've got many sort of different hats that you wear and many different roles and so forth. And yes, there's certain roles within the business and within the industry, but you also do a fair amount of work within the third sector, the not-for-profit sector as well. You've had a continuous involvement with that. So talk to us a little bit about some of those initiatives that you've been involved with, and more importantly, how do you add value, and how does that add value to your personal and professional growth?
Quite a lot of the third sector work that we do tends to be in the hospitality industry at the moment. That, as you know, that's where we're most well known. We've been supporters of the Springboard charity for many years, and until very recently we've been doing a lot of work on their ambassador program, which basically is kind of a mentoring program that helps people who are thinking about the industry or people who are new to the industry to get a little bit of support in their roles. We do something similar with the Institute of Hospitality. Also within Springboard, we support Future Chef, which is a program, it's a fabulous program. If you ever get a chance to go along to a school that's doing a Future Chef competition, go. It's just young people who are thinking about a career in hospitality. They compete across the country. They produce their food. And local schools, lots of local schools get engaged. It starts off with thousands of kids and you end up you know, with one winner at the end of it. But they are extraordinary young people and that's such a great thing to be part of. We also work with the Craft Guild of Chefs on National Young Chef of the Year, which we've sponsored for many years. So we do a lot of work around that. But also in terms of inclusion, I'm on the Apprenticeship Diversity Champions Network. Mm. And that's, again, that's very broad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, diversity means a lot to a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's something different to everyone. And within that network, for a few years ago, we thought, you know, this is kind of, it's not very focused. It's not very targeted. So that we split down into working groups. And I mean, you'll know lots of people who work. Lucy Hunt, for example, our dear friend at the NHS, she's part of that network too. And we all worked on different projects. So I was very interested in inclusion for people with learning differences. And out of that, it made us go and look for opportunities within funding and grants that might be available to support that. We became part of a Department for Education pilot to enable more people who have difficulties with English and maths to participate in apprenticeships. So fundamentally, the principle of an apprenticeship is competence proven over time.
Yeah.
Right? That's a bit of an old-fashioned explanation, but if we think of an apprenticeship as competence, it's all about competence. There are lots of apprenticeships out there that don't necessarily need you to have a particularly high level of English or maths or both in order to become occupationally competent. Now, there's a rule within the apprenticeship funding that allows exemptions for people who have got a particular diagnosis and can prove it. But, of course, lots of people go through the entirety of their school life.
Yeah.
And unless you've really pushed it out there, a lot of people go to completely undiagnosed, and especially individuals over a certain age. I think back to some of the kids that I was at school with, and they were labelled as naughty. They weren't naughty. They were just labelled as naughty because their behaviours weren't the same as you might expect for other people. But it doesn't mean that they couldn't get to be fantastically occupationally competent. So we're undertaking this pilot at the moment. It's been really successful. The first 9 months, we've had 10 times as many people go through it as we had in the whole of the previous year.
Mm.
So it's really important to me. It ends in May. It's really important that we make sure that the news about that is out there so that we can ensure that other people in the future across all types of training providers, not just us, this isn't just about HIT, this is about all training providers of apprenticeships being able to facilitate those opportunities for people who otherwise might be labelled failures for the rest of their days just because their English and maths isn't fantastic.
Okay, so just to recap, it's a pilot funded by the Department for Education, specifically aimed at functional skills and allowing people to do an apprenticeship without necessarily...
It's applying the existing rules in a more flexible way.
Right.
That allows my special education needs coordinator to assess somebody as whether they can access those arrangements rather than them having to have had a statement or diagnosis through the traditional school system.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, good luck with that. And hopefully, you know, that will allow the government and the powers that be to sort of take on board some of those sort of challenges. And I think it's an absolute game changer, really. It's definitely a big deal and should be highlighting that a little bit more, particularly some of the impact that you would no doubt have.
I mean, and some people think, well, that will mean level to entry level or intermediate apprenticeships, but not necessarily. You know, if you think about it, each apprenticeship has got a different need for English and maths. Each job role requires more or less writing, more or less language skills, more or less maths. So it's quite possible. And something that AELP did was put forward a paper that suggested that actually What we should be doing is saying within each apprenticeship, this is what you require through the core skills of English and maths in order to be able to complete the programme. Because, you know, here's the news, apprenticeships are the only programme of study that require you to have both English and maths functional skills at the end of it. You don't need it for your degree.
Jill, I mean, I tell you, you know, when we're in the sector, we sort of sometimes see these things and we say it's a bit obvious, but it takes us a little while and the right level of communication to actually get the message out there. So I know you've done a fair amount of work in terms of policy, sort of advocating and sort of trying to influence people who make these decisions. I mean, tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've been involved with. I know you've been sitting on sort of parliamentary groups and various other things and various sort of initiatives throughout sort of your working life.
It changes. Yeah. I mean, it changes because different groups want your participation at different times. So for a period of about 10 years, I was on an advisory group that was all about further education. And on that group, we had representatives from the sixth forms, from FE colleges, from special colleges, from specialist programs, apprenticeship provider. We were the only apprenticeship provider there at the time. So we were quite a broad range of people. And that was really useful because it was a Chatham House rules, get round a table every couple of months and really talk honestly about some of the challenges that are happening out there. And you know, the people from Holex were there as well. So, you know, it was very broad. It was very broad. And I think it was a very useful methodology, but unfortunately that went away. I get called into all parts of parliamentary group conversations pretty regularly, not just around apprenticeships, but also, you know, the brewing sector, the pub sector, hospitality, care, and we're called as special witnesses as well quite regularly, so we do that. I'm also part of an advisory group that works alongside Ofsted, so I feed into that too. And then, of course, lots and lots of my staff, the specialist staff, are working on trailblazers to make sure that the apprenticeships that we've got for the sectors we work in are completely relevant and remain relevant, but also remain deliverable. Mm. One of the mistakes that IFATE made when they first started standards, apprenticeship standards, was they didn't get the training providers into the room soon enough. And so some of the apprenticeships that they developed weren't really viable, they weren't deliverable, or they couldn't be endpoint assessed properly because the assessment criteria that they'd put in place were just too complex. Mm. So yeah, we support all of that as well. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, if I can bring you back to...
Thanks to Jill Whittaker, the Executive Chair at HIT Training Limited, for her insight and time. Next week, we'll have the second half of this conversation with Jill Whittaker. So if you don't want to miss that, then remember to subscribe or follow us. If you're new to the podcast, let me tell you there are already 84 other Canny Conversations podcast episodes out there. And you can listen to all those past episodes by searching for Canny Conversations on your preferred podcast platform. Or go to 1386audio.com/have-a-listen. We'd also love it if you could review, subscribe, or follow the podcast. And please tell your friends and colleagues about us. If you'd like to know more, then go to cannyconversationspodcast.co.uk or go to Safraz's website. That's safraz.co.uk. Safraz has also written a series of easy-to-follow business books, Canny Bites, and these are available from cannybites.co.uk/buy-the-book. As I said, we'll be back next week, where you'll be able to hear the second half of SAF's conversation with Jill Whittaker, the Executive Chair at HIT Training Limited. So until then, have a good week.
This is a 1386 audio production.